Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Grand Rapids and began working as a checkout clerk in her parents' five-and-dime store at age 7. She earned a degree at night from Grand Valley State University while working as a reporter for the Grand Rapids Press. She joined Crane's Detroit business in 1989 and today is the vice president and publisher. She's also the first female president of the Detroit Athletic Club. Her name, Mary Kramer, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Mary Kramer, the vice president and publisher of Crane's Detroit business. Mary, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack.
Can you start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Well, my parents are two of my favorite topics. I feel very lucky to have the parents that I have. And I grew up in Grand Rapids on the banks of the Grand River and had a great childhood, really, because my parents were Depression babies. You know, they grew up during the Depression. They went through World War II. My dad was a Normandy Beach guy, Omaha Beach, and did not graduate from high school. He had to quit in the 1930s to support his family before he got married. And I think that what that created in our family was a sense of gratitude for the life that they had, a sense of raising six kids and making sure that they had the best education they could be given, and just a great environment growing up. I had a great childhood.
Your dad was at D-Day.
Yes.
A few days ago, A few days ago, we had the anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Did your dad ever talk about that experience?
It's interesting. He didn't. And only as he died of cancer in 1985. And shortly before he died, my mother and I took him to Normandy. He had never wanted to go back to Europe. He had never wanted to talk about the war. And then suddenly, I think because he, you know, was going through cancer treatments, et cetera, and he had a period of time where he was able to travel, and we went back, and it was really one of the most powerful things. And I, alone of the six kids, was able to go, and I wouldn't have traded that for the world. It was amazing. And then he did talk a little bit during that trip. But this was a guy who went in. We went to the church where he was supposed to rendezvous with the men in his units, and only six guys showed up. We found the church. He became a lieutenant by default because of the mortality rates of the, he was in the Big Red One, the first division. So it was just getting to see my father and learning that history was just it was a privilege.
What did you learn from your mom and dad?
Well, they were work ethic predominantly, and the love of education and reading. My father was a huge history buff. We took these trips all over the United States, six kids, parents in a station wagon. We'd stop at every historical marker, you know, that we would ever come across. And I think that's the kind of thing that I took away from my childhood, was learning to read, loving history, loving writing, and an appreciation for education from two people who wish they had the pedigree and the academic credentials.
What did your mom and dad do?
Well, my dad was in sales when, you know, during the 1940s, after he came back from the war, he got involved in sales, and they lived in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he had an opportunity to become a sales manager for an appliance company, Admiral, which is an old brand name, and moved to Grand Rapids for that territory. And after a few years, he decided that he didn't really want to work for anybody else, and he bought an old dime store. And in Grand Rapids, and my mother insinuated herself in the business over time. I don't think she really wanted to be so much a stay-at-home mom, and she was excellent at bookkeeping and things like that. And they became partners in the business, and we had all of the kids were basically between the house and the store. I mean, that was our life. We worked in the business and got to go to New York and Chicago on buying trips and. Just had a terrific childhood getting involved in that business.
You started at age 7 in the store.
Yes, that's
what
how
jobs?
We got to the favorite was marking new merchandise. We were dusting shelves and taking care of inventory. I was a checkout person as well. All of the kids were. And basically, you know, we had a little orbit where after school I would go to the store and not every day, but most days. And then we'd go home as a family after the store closed.
Did they pay you?
I think I started out at 10 cents an hour, and I think my last wage was $1 an hour. And my dad kept track. We got to see how much we were getting. We didn't get it directly. It was for our college fund.
from one pocket to the other pocket. When did you first know you wanted to be a writer?
That was in high school. I went to Catholic Central High School in Grand Rapids, and I took a journalism class from Jim Bidelick, a teacher there, and it was a great experience. I got involved in the student paper. Probably one of the experiences that occurred was we had some things in the paper that, you know, it's a private school. Looking back, it was a private school, but we had these heady ideas of freedom of the press, and this is in the 1960s, and ultimately our paper was shut down, and our advisor was fired, and it was kind of a galvanizing experience at that young age, and it kind of propelled me into going into journalism.
We're talking to Mary Kramer. And when we come back, we'll talk to her about working and going to school full time. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Mary Kramer, who in 2003 became the first female president of the DAC. Quite an honor. How did you handle working full-time and going to school?
Well, Jack, I was already enrolled full-time at Grand Valley, and I had a summer internship at the Grand Rapids Press. And I don't know exactly how this happened, but at the end of the summer, I think they thought I was a graduating senior. So they offered me a job, and I never told them, hey, I haven't graduated from college yet. I just took the job and rearranged my schedule and started going to school one class a semester at night. And it was tough because journalists, it's not a 9-to-5 job. I mean, this is a job that you don't know what your hours are going to be. It depends on the stories you're working on. So it was kind of difficult to juggle, not knowing if I could make a class or trying to work around the classes that I was taking. And it took 6 years, but I eventually got the degree, and I'm very, very glad I did. The other thing about that experience was having worked while I was working, I just got to know more about the Grand Rapids area, and I wanted to know more. So if I was taking a class on urban history or something like that, I would tend to write my papers about something that would help me at work, like the 1911 furniture strike in Grand Rapids, which really shaped a lot of the history in that town. So I got to know more than I might otherwise know about that community, and it really made me a better journalist.
There's a lot of people today, 30, 40, 50, mm-hmm. that are being faced with the reality of having to go back to school to learn a new craft. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give these people?
Well, first, I think that it's important that they realize that people with real-life work experience add a lot to any classroom. I mean, just because they don't have the academic pedigree doesn't mean that they can't do this, they can't go back to school. They will enrich the classes that they are in because they have what a lot of the regular traditional college-age students don't have, and that's life experience. So they're going to bring a lot to the classroom. Second, I think if I were at Delphi or some of these other companies that are experiencing the problems, I would be putting my plans together now to figure out what are my interest areas, what am I good at, what do I like, and figuring out what are the careers or what are the jobs that are built around those interest areas. I'm sure there's so many people in manufacturing now, because of the technology of the manufacturing process, have learned to use math. They're using applied technology. And so if that's something that they could build on, I'd figure out what is the fastest credential I can earn in order to build into a new livelihood. And I hope the companies are helping their people do that.
It seems to me, Mary, that a great writer must first be a great listener.
I think I'd agree with that. I think also a lot of times very good writers are also good readers. I mean, they read. And I was a reader. I've never considered myself a great writer. I think that I am proficient in the craft of journalism, but I don't think I have the great literary gift. I wish I did. But I do think that you develop in time with journalism. It's telling stories. It's listening to people and connecting the dots and telling a story. And I guess I grew up with a fabulous storyteller, my father, and I certainly got an appreciation for reading from him. And I think that the attraction I had for journalism was both the idea that you get paid to go to work every day and learn something new is pretty fabulous.
A great salesperson also has to be a great listener.
That's true.
How does someone become a great listener?
Not talking. Asking questions and listening and not trying to, you know, I've heard people in broadcast, and obviously in broadcast you get to hear the interviewer. In journalism you don't get to see or hear how the journalist is approaching the interview so much. You get to read the finished product. But in broadcast, I think the what I have admired are the people who ask great questions and let the guest, as you do on this show, let the guest just talk and without putting their own opinions in and dominating the conversation.
One of the things I admire about you is you always are trying to learn.
Hmm.
Why?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's genetic. Maybe it's just that I'm drawn to that idea of I don't have a PhD. I don't have a master's. I have a Bachelor of Arts degree. So I'm not, you know, I don't have the fabulous academic pedigree, but I do have, I'm inquisitive, and I like to know things. It's just innate. I don't know how to say where that came from. I just like to know.
I read recently that in today's business world, you have to keep learning while you are earning.
I think that's true, and I think that's kind of goes along with what people are going through in the manufacturing sector these days. Even now, even if we were not having economic problems within the automotive industry, the domestic automotive industry, I know that people like Dick Dauch, for example, at American Axle, he has a specific budget for every employee. You know, they go through X number of hours of training, X number of hours of education on site at that company. And I think that's one of the reasons he has invested so much in that company in terms of training, on-the-job training, that's one of the reasons I think that company has not had as many of the problems that some of the other companies are experiencing.
On Monday mornings, you're on with Paul W. to talk about what's in this week's issue of Cranes.
That's right.
This past Monday, you were talking to him about the Lions.
That's right. Very timely.
What has to change to be successful? Every article you're writing, every topic you have is a different theme,
mm-hmm.
a different industry.
Mm-hmm.
How do you become conversant on so many different topics?
Well, I know a little about a lot of things, and I think that might be a definition of a dilettante. I'm not sure, but I think that's part of what you acquire as a journalist. Now, we are so fortunate at Cranes. We have 10 beat reporters, and they are the experts on those beats. And the editors, what our job is to help orchestrate their work, support their work, and help them set priorities in their work. But they're the ones who are out there, and they should be expert in healthcare, finance, nonprofits, philanthropy, all the different things that we cover. The beat reporters are really the experts, and the editors are sort of the facilitators.
If you were talking to a young person who loves to write and is thinking about writing as a career, what advice would you give them?
Well, if they want to support themselves by writing, I would suggest journalism. I think a lot of people who think they want to write and they want to write creatively, they feel this literary bug. I think it's also nice to have the opportunity to have a job that would actually give you a paycheck, because the creative writing, and you know, there isn't a great American novel written every week, you know. So to support yourself, you're either going to have a journalism job or some other kind of job, perhaps teaching, that's going to support that creative writing effort. Right now, I think the thing with media in general is there is a technology explosion, and I think that the traditional journalism programs are geared towards broadcast outlets and daily newspapers, but they have not really looked at other opportunities for good journalism, such as publications that are niche publications or trade publications. Automotive News, our sister publication, is a terrific worldwide authority on the automotive industry. Yet, if you go to most journalism programs in America today, they don't even know what those kinds of publications are, and they don't encourage people to look at them. In addition to the traditional media, though, there's a lot of opportunity because of technology in new forms of media, online, downloadable. The key is content. You're always going to need content.
We're talking to Mary Kramer, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Mary Kramer, who joined Crane's Detroit business in 1989. Mary, how did that happen?
Well, it's kind of a 6 degrees of separation story, Jack. I was the city editor of the Kalamazoo Gazette at the time, and I got a call from the founding editor of Crane's Detroit business, Peter Brown. And Peter and I had overlapped at the Ann Arbor News in the mid-80s. And he had gone on from the Ann Arbor News to the Detroit Free Press and then helped Keith Crane start Crane's Detroit business in 1985. So he was calling me in 1989, and I thought he was going to ask me, do you know anybody who would be good at this job, somebody with business journalism experience? So I started to anticipate that as he described the opening. And I said, gee, I'll give it some thought and I'll let you know if I can think of anybody. He said, no, I want you to come and interview. And I had never really thought of myself in business journalism because I was such a big community journalism person. But after I came down for the interview and met Keith Crane, it really sealed the deal. I mean, Keith is an amazing publisher, and he's chairman of a company, privately held company, that has 30 publications that are all respected in their fields. He puts the reader and the journalism first, and in media these days, that is a big deal. And I admire his principles and ethics, and it's been a privilege to work at the company.
In the late 70s, you took a personality assessment test, which predicted that you would make a wonderful subordinate.
Yeah, that was right after I got promoted to my first management job in daily journalism, and they sent me to kind of a shrink, and corporate shrink. And I remember interpreting ink blots and all different kinds of things in a day-long thing, and was crushed when they told me at the end of the assessment, after they evaluated the information, that I really was a good subordinate, but I would never be a leader.
A lot of people are told something, and they take that as gospel for the rest of their life. How did you have the courage to say, no thanks, I can do this?
I was very upset by the assessment. My boss at the time reinforced that feeling in words that I cannot express on radio. And I guess it was by learning by doing. I showed myself that I could be a leader over time.
We're talking to Mary Kramer. When we come back, we'll ask her, how is the newspaper business going to change in the next 5 to 10 years? And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Mary Kramer. Mary, how is your business going to change in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, journalism in general in this country is changing dramatically. You're already seeing this huge consolidation of ownership of daily newspapers and broadcast properties. The change in ownership of the two Detroit dailies earlier this year is a good example of that. And then you open the paper today, and what do you see? Little item that says, Gannett Newspapers is considering acquisitions, including acquiring Knight Ridder, its former competitor here in the Detroit market. So part of what's changing is huge consolidation of publicly traded companies that own media properties. And that is one of the reasons that I really am grateful that I work for a privately held, family-owned business in journalism that has great journalism values that is not affected by the quarterly expectations of Wall Street, which can influence budgets and how much money you put into the, quote, product, which is the content, the journalism. I think it's going to change dramatically and not necessarily for the better.
We don't want to wait till 6 o'clock to listen to Tom Brokaw tell us what happened throughout the day. We can go on the cable, we can go on the internet, and get it instantaneously. We don't want to wait till Monday to read all your articles. How does that affect your business?
Well, that actually is a positive, and that is that the consumer, the reader, the user of media, is more in control. They get the information on their time, not an appointment time of sitting down to watch Tom Brokaw at 6 o'clock. So that's a huge change, and all media is working to try and keep up with that and come up with business models that will support the journalism. But people are so now accustomed online to getting information for free that the business models have to be different. It's free distribution mostly on most of these sites with advertising supporting the site. And that, depending on the site, can be a difficult business model to uphold. So I think that the technology is making consumers more in control of their media choices. But at the same time, some of the media that's out there, some of the sites, you also have to take responsibility as a consumer to understand where is this information coming, how accurate is it? Because Wikipedia, for example, which is a popular resource guide online, has been criticized by people for having inaccurate information that's supplied by people who use the site themselves. They're not vetting it enough. And there was a pretty famous case of someone who was accused of being part of a conspiracy in Wikipedia that had absolutely nothing to do with the conspiracy and could sue for damages.
What do you look for when you hire a person?
I look for, one of the key questions that I ask is, what do you read? And one of the alarming things, Jack, that just really dismays me is how many people, young people in their 20s, you know, late teens, 20s, do not read. And they're in journalism programs, for God's sake. They're in journalism programs and they're not reading. So that's the number one question. I don't care how bright somebody is or appears to be. If they're not reading, that's a huge mark that a deficit in my mind. Other things that I would like to assess is, you know, we do some testing. We ask people to write stories when they come to Crane. Just try a story, unless they are very established in the field. We talk to them about how they approach stories. We'd like to see if they like to learn, because that's, again, one of the key factors. Or do they think they know everything?
You personally, what do you read?
Oh, I read, well, actually, I read a mixture of things. I read a couple of papers every day online, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And I read the Free Press and the News as well. And then I have other sites online that I go to periodically. So I'm reading quite a bit every day. Online helps because you can look at the headline and click on the story. I personally like that. But there's that serendipity of turning the page and seeing what's on the next page and seeing an article that you might not have thought you were interested in, but something draws you in. So I still like the hard copy.
Well, you got quite a life. You get paid very well to read and to learn.
Don't tell Keith Crane, okay? It's a pretty good gig.
You are a great networker. You have one of Michigan's best Rolodexes, which is extremely valuable in the business world today. How did you become a great networker?
Well, I think part of it is when I came to Crane, I was new to Detroit, and this was the largest area I'd ever lived in. So I started going to things, and I would collect business cards and jot myself notes, etc. And I'm kind of a joiner, and I like to get involved in things, and my networks would start to grow. And I think the key, though, is that I also believe in something that I never knew what to call it. And then I read this book a couple years ago called Bowling Alone by a Harvard researcher named Robert Putnam. And his theory was that American life is getting is deteriorating because people don't connect anymore, that our social capital and our social networks are frayed. And that's hence the title Bowling Alone. And he called this social capital, that it's where I connect with you and I have a connection with you through clubs or organizations, and also through this idea that I might do you a favor. You might call me and say, I need somebody who knows how to do this. And if I can supply that person, you and I have now exchanged social capital. I believe in that strongly. I think it's the karma of that comes back to you. And I think I think I've helped to develop that for myself and for others in the last few years.
One of the hardest things for most people to do is give a speech. You give speech after speech. Mm-hmm. I believe you threw up after the first speech.
Yeah. Actually, that's true, Jack. That happened in Grand Rapids when I worked at the Grand Rapids Press. I was asked to speak at something, and I thought, what was I thinking? Am I out of my mind? But I really didn't know that I had that fear until I tried it, and I just was paralyzing. Then when I came to Crane, and the last words Keith had as I left my interview with him, he said, and by the way, there's a lot of public speaking with this job. You're okay with that, right? And I said, oh, yeah, sure, fine. And went back to Kalamazoo, immediately called my next-door neighbor who had just gotten a master's in communication and speech. And I hired her, not really hired her, but I asked her to be my personal trainer to learn how to give a speech. And she helped me. I delivered a speech within about 6 weeks of taking the job at Crane, got over the fear, and now I actually enjoy speaking to people.
I guess if somebody's going to throw up after a speech, better that the speaker do it than the audience do it, right? What advice would you give to somebody who's never given a speech and now has to start to do that regularly?
Well, a couple of things. One is you have to really know who you're speaking to, and you got to know the audience. And like whether it's a small audience, a large audience, smaller audiences, I think you can be less formal. But I started by writing things down, the entire text. And that helped me a lot. And now I can just, you know, work with outlines and that sort of thing. But to get started, I had to write the thesis down and develop the speech around that and write all of the text down. And then I delivered it in front of a mirror. I mean, I had to try that.
You give a lot of talks to women's groups.
Mm-hmm.
What's the basic message that you try to get across?
Well, you know, I think when I talk to the women's groups, what I find is that Even today, there is an energy in those groups. There is women like to connect. They're very social. They put a premium on the social capital that I was talking about before. And I talked to them about tools for business success because, you know, they look at the position that I have at Cranes and a kind of a leadership role in some business circles in Southeast Michigan. And they have aspirations and they would like advice and tips on how to juggle it all because women are so darn busy. You have to remember that most of them are running households as well, even though their husbands or significant others may play a role in managing that. It really comes back most times to the woman. So she's got a lot on her plate. Prioritizing and balancing, that is what people want to know how to do better.
We're talking to Mary Kramer, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Mary Kramer, who was the chairperson of Leadership Detroit. Mm-hmm. Mary, who are your role models? Who are your heroes?
That's a good question, Jack. And, you know, it's one that I don't think of very often because even though there are so many people I admire, I am so much of the moment. I think that there's a lot of people in history that I admire, particularly women who have done extraordinary things, especially given the time, like Eleanor Roosevelt is a particular hero. But contemporary heroes, when I moved to Detroit, it's been my privilege and pleasure to meet so many people who are living role models. And one who I think of often is, I get to see her a lot, and is Eleanor Jasaitis at Focus Hope. And I admire her because of the example that she sets. Focus Hope, she co-founded it with Father Cunningham. She was number two to him. He was the big charismatic guy out in public all the time, all the accolades. Then he became ill and she stepped up and she has succeeded him as the CEO of Focus Hope and gone through some very tough times. And in her own, she came up with her own leadership style. She has led that organization and attracted some very top names in Metro Detroit business to support the organization. She gives back selflessly.
Speaking of that, you've been a pathfinder over and over. The first female president of the DAC, vice president, publisher of Cranes. How have you gotten the courage to take on these great challenges?
Well, I wish I could say that there's a big five-year plan and that I've thought these things out meticulously, but I have taken advantages of opportunities as they've come to me. And I think one of the things that has allowed me to take a little bit of risk is years ago, in the early 1980s, I did take a job at a paper in Buffalo, New York, and I arrived in August and left my, you know, I was kind of like the Jimmy Stewart of Grand Rapids, the Bedford Falls. I never thought I would leave that wonderful town. But I did take this other job, and 6 weeks after, the publicly traded company, or the family-owned company, excuse me, that owned the paper, their board made a decision to close the paper down. So I had just uprooted myself, sold my house, said goodbye to my friends. 6 weeks later, I find I have no job. So I looked at that experience as, okay, what's the worst thing that can happen? And that's my new barometer. What's the worst thing that could happen? You lose your job, you find another one. And maybe because of the chain of events that occurred, it might be, you might be better off in the long run. Who knows? I'm a very optimistic person. So I think that's part of what has helped me a little bit to take risk.
What advice would you give to young people today?
Well, taking risks is a good piece of advice. Of course, I think that one of the things that I've been lucky, very lucky about, is I have found a career path and a niche in communications and journalism that is something that I love. And to this day, I feel like getting up and going to work in the morning, it's not work. It's not work the way people dread Mondays. You know, I happen to love Mondays because that's when Cranes is delivered. But I've always had that sense. And so many of my friends have college-age children, and they ask, oh, would you talk to, you know, my son or daughter about what they want to do? And you know what's so sad is these kids sometimes are graduating from college 4 years of investment in their education, and they have not a clue what they want to do in the work life or in their own life. There's no passion. That's sad.
Is the American dream still alive?
Oh, I think you can see it all over Detroit, all over Metro Detroit. You see people who, particularly the people who have built their own businesses, and they find the opportunity. You know, we did a section in Cranes a few years ago called American Dreamers, and we identified almost 100 people who were born outside the United States, came to the United States with virtually nothing, and had built a life and a livelihood here. Those stories of those people, I mean, it's trite. You say, it sounds trite, but they came with $20 in their pocket, went to Wayne State University, got a degree, started working at Ford, quit Ford, started their own company, and here they are. Their company's $100 million a year or something. I mean, amazing stories, and they happen in Metro Detroit every day.
Are you hopeful about the future of the city?
I'm concerned because... in addition to all the other problems that the region has, we now have the domestic auto industry's problems overlaying all of the other issues that exist in Southeast Michigan. I am hopeful about Detroit. I think since I moved here in 1989, the city is a better place than it was then in many, many ways. But the continued problems of racism, regional identity, regional cooperation seem to evade this region, and I guess I'd like to, if I were a psychiatrist, I'd like to put Southeast Michigan on the couch and figure out what's going on here, and how can we be a better region, and how can we be more, I hate to say it, like Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids, if you go to Grand Rapids, you go to Chicago, these places have pride. Business people are proud to live and work in these communities. And in Detroit, in Metro Detroit, I don't feel that same sense of pride.
I heard you once give a talk, and you talked about that we have to learn to let go of this union versus management,
mm-hmm.
city versus suburb,
mm-hmm.
black versus white. How do people learn to let go?
That's a good question. I think partly if people have relationships with one another and can talk to each other, I think that's a start. I don't even think that people who are on opposite sides of some of these issues know each other. They know they speak to each other, they have to work with each other, but I don't think they know each other as people. It's very hard to debate and to demonize someone you know that as a person, even if they're not your best friend. The point is that if you know them as a person, it's very difficult for you to cast those kind of strident, remarks about people. So I think part of it in this metro area, we are shaped by our history. Labor is a big part of the history in Southeast Michigan. Labor also is a way of looking at the world in terms of negotiation and bargaining. And I think that in some ways that has helped shape, if I win, you must lose. If you win, I must lose. So it's just this historical context that I think we have to get through.
What are you the proudest of?
Proudest of. I think I'm very proud of the position that I hold today. But on a personal level, I'm very close to my family. I'm not married. I don't have children, but I have. Five siblings, and my mother is a widow. She's moved to the Detroit area. I'm very proud that she is a big part of my life. I have an older brother with multiple disabilities. I think I've made a difference in his life. He's certainly made a difference in mine for the better. And I'm very proud of our relationship, really. That's what I'm proudest of.
Whenever I hear a person talk about a family member who's been challenged in some way,
mm-hmm.
I hear the words gift, angel, inspiration, my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Mary, why is that?
Well, I think that in my case, I'm a type A person. I'm an overachiever. And what Steve has helped me do is become more patient and learn through his perspective. I've learned so much. It's amazing.
You seem to be happy. What's the key to being happy? Other than having a job where you can read all day, go to the DAC, have breakfast and lunch.
Oh, I hope Keith isn't listening. I don't know. I guess it's just I do have a good life, and I'm very grateful for the life that I have. I've worked, anybody can say they've worked to get where they are. And I just think that in my case, I've taken advantage of the opportunities as they've come and they've worked out.
Mary, I want to thank you from all of us in this region who benefit from all you and your team does. Our guest next Sunday will be the third longest serving U.S. congressman in American history, John Dingell. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because anything is possible. Spall.